This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Computer, who is the Aston Villa manager?
Aston Villa's manager is Dean Smith.
Lovely.
Wow.
Ooh, back in the game.
The Illuminati have spoken.
Ask computer who are Villa's centre backs. Mila Jedinek. Fuck off.
Computer, who are Aston Villa's centre backs?
I don't know that one.
Yep, neither did Steve Bruce.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Able to dig out across to somebody. Abraham! 1-0 to Aston Villa. Sammy Abraham nods it in front of the North Stand. And Abraham rose above all to give Dean Smith the dream start in the dugout.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com. Joining me, two gentlemen like myself who are transitioning from the Mad Few to Dean Smith's Claret Blue Army, Dan Rogers from the villaunderground.com and Chris Budd. Welcome.
Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Dean Smith's Claret Blue Army. Now, when I first heard that against Swansea, I was thinking, here's a guy that needs to get his name changed by Deepole so we can just have a funkier Claret Blue Army song. Dean Smith's Claret Blue Army.
I like it. It's functional.
I want something a bit sexier. What do you think?
Just to make the song flow a bit better, he could use an extra syllable.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
And Dean Smith's just doesn't cut it.
Listen, watching what you've had a Julio, you've had a Remy Gard. You've had what else? We've been down that road.
We're bringing it closer to home. Back to Great Bar.
It's organic. It's natural. It's
time to get back to basics, is it?
That's right. It's
basic names. We were obviously all there in the Holt for his first game, full house, apart from the hospitality seats, which I noticed there was a few empty rows there. Do you think it was a bit OTT, the big welcome?
I get it. You know, they want to make a big deal of it. And I think because it coincided with the Doug Ellis tributes and stuff, it was always going to happen. And with Terry coming back to Villa, it was, you know, with the PR department the way they are, they were always going to jump on it, weren't they?
Yeah, it was like a returning hero, but he actually hasn't done anything. He's just a fan of Villa, like ourselves.
And I thought, to Smith's credit, he did try to play that down in his press conference. I thought that he acknowledged the link through his father, but also wanted to be quite clear that his connection through football hasn't been at Villa, has it? So it was a bit of a weird introduction in the build up, and the way the social media attacked it, I suppose, was a bit of an odd one, and weirdly juxtaposed against the Ellis thing on the day as well.
Yeah, the Ellis thing was a bit strange because I thought it was going to be a minute silence. I don't know if I was just assumed that, or if that was what the initial word came out and the crowd just started the applause instead of a silence. But then the guy with the mic just kept talking and I couldn't hear it. I was up in the upper Holt. So I didn't know what he was saying, but it was just, he seemed a bit confused. I think they invited a few players from the past who obviously played while Ellis was in charge.
I thought it was a weird one. Whilst I think the vast majority of Villa fans would be respectful, I think, and were respectful of the passing of Ellis, I think there was, from my point of view, there's been a bit of revisionism both on the day and in the lead-up, I think, as to the Ellis era. And I think that perhaps fans of a certain age may not remember quite how Villa stagnated over the period. And I mean, I'm not going to labour my point, but I think if people do their reading around Ellis and where Villa didn't go and where he came from, I think things are actually slightly different.
You know, anybody who passes away, especially when it comes to social media, the tributes are always like, well, it's kind of respectful, isn't it? But no, I completely agree. And you know, when you go a bit over the top on revisionism, because you know we're of the age where we saw Villa when we were like bigger than Arsenal and Spurs, and this is not counting obviously Chelsea and Manchester City, who obviously had the home run of a big money owner come in. But Arsenal and Spurs, we've been outdone because we were held back over decades. But anyway, let's move on to other things. We'll talk about Dean Smith and the new coaching staff, and obviously the sporting director. And we'll throw in a bit of context from the Swansea game. At the end, we'll have a new feature now. Where were you when we were good? Obviously, a little spin on the song. Where were you when we were shit? Where we look at kind of in idiosyncratic moments in Villa history that aren't the most celebrated, but either spin into a fun historical Villa story, or were actually more poignant than they actually seemed at the time. But first, let's have 3 points. Former Villa captain Gareth Southgate carries on the England gravy train with in the international break, while all the craziness was going down at Villa. As well as getting a draw in Croatia, who were obviously humbled us in the semi-finals, he managed to, I thought we were going to hammer Spain when we were 3-0 up, but they still managed to hold on. And do any of you two know exactly what the UEFA Nations League is? Because I still...
Not a clue.
Still no idea.
I think more importantly, is anyone bothered?
No. But all I know is... if you finish bottom, you get relegated.
To where?
I don't know. Out of Europe. So I thought...
Brexit.
you get Brexited.
Oh, I'll have to go and play Canada and China in some other league.
So I think we've got one game left against home at Croatia. And I think to avoid Brexit, I think we need a draw, I think, bottom line. I think the top teams go through to the next round, don't they? Into a knockout, I'm assuming, anyway.
It's like a never-ending nightmare of pointless games that are just basically friendlies rebranded, isn't it?
But it seems to have livened them up a bit. There's things at stake. I think especially for the lower nations who can... Because allegedly, I need to fact-check this, but there's a gateway into the European Championships. I mean, the only other Villa connection apart from Southgate, not that we need a Villa connection for the 3 points. A few Villa fans got their flags nicked, you know, the St. George flags with Villa. But, I mean, I've spoke to somebody, I think Coventry fan who was over there, and, you know, he was saying how the fans are now starting to up their game in terms of how they tie their flags, you know, to posts or walls or whatever when they're in the pubs of, you know, the respective country. And they're using those builders' plastic, what do they call those plastic?
Cable ties.
Cable ties. Some are even using metal cable ties now. It's a whole new industry now. How to stop some little pikies nicking your flags and turning them upside down for social media photos.
That's what it's about, isn't it? Yeah.
I would carry a cattle prod and electrify the fence that the actual flag's on.
Great shout.
Also, I would write upside down on the flag, "These guys are a bunch of wankers." So if they do nick the flag and then post it upside down, then the writing will be the right way round, and it will say, "These guys are a bunch of wankers," and they won't understand what the English is. Anyway, moving on to point number two. Thierry Henry, future Aston Villa manager, if this podcast was a month ago, now has a 0% win ratio as a manager after the Monaco's loss 2-1 away to Strasbourg.
Featuring rubbish. A dreadful goalkeeping mistake.
Well, we nearly had a few of those. As I said to somebody who was watching the Swansea game, why haven't the Swansea manager worked out that you just got to shoot halfway line and closer. Just shoot on sight.
Just cross the ball in.
Yeah, exactly.
It's in the air.
I mean, it's only one game, poor Henry, but we will see how that pans out. I mean, it's kind of a sideshow now, isn't it, for Villa fans to see how Henry continues. And most of them, I'm sure, will want him to fail just to feel good about themselves.
Well, he hasn't took an easy job on there. I mean, Monaco are in the bottom three of the French league, so good luck with that one.
Yeah, it's kind of a rebuilding job, but he's using the Pep word all the time and saying that he's his guru, so I'm sure he's on the end of the phone as a potential mentor if he needs him. So, I mean, it'll be interesting. It's instant gratification, obviously, nowadays in football. You'd think with Henry, you'd give him a couple of seasons just to get his, feet under the table.
Mm.
Point number three, Moms, or myself, a couple of months ago was invited to join the West Midlands Police Football Unit Independent Advisory Group, which is basically a group that meets the police and they tell us, you know, what's going on, their side of the story, and we tell them what we're not impressed with, ask for an explanation of things. The makeup of the group is basically the six West Midlands teams, apart from Wolves, actually. They don't seem to have a rep, but you've got somebody from Warsaw, Coventry, Blues, Baggies, Villa.
All the big clubs, then.
All the big clubs. So, you know, we all share our issues and intelligence, I suppose. It's the first group in this country, this group that's set up to advise the police, to be a critical friend.
Mm.
So this is something in the football corridors, like the Football Supporters Federation, that they're trying to push on all police forces in the country. So at this meeting, as an example of good practice, this is only my second meeting, we had the Met Police down, a couple of reps from them, we had a couple of reps from Yorkshire Police, Bedford Police. So they're all there to like check it out. And they all loved it, by the way. They gave their feedback at the end, and it was all double thumbs up. But anyway, when we got into the Villa, I was on about the cabbage. And I said, what's the situation with the cabbage? And I think these guys from the other police forces were thinking, well, we've come to the right place because this cabbage is like the most famous thing in UK football at the moment. So we get to see get the inside track on the cabbage. So I asked for an update on the cabbage.
Was this in AOBs, or was it an agenda item in its own right?
I rose the cabbage question. And, they said they'd apprehended somebody, allegedly.
Fucking apprehended somebody.
And I was saying, like, come on. I said, like, in the press, that I've got some headlines here. West Midlands police hunt man who hurled cabbage towards Aston Villa manager Bruce. I think that was the, like, Independent. You're a fucking disgrace. An eyewitness account of the cabbage attack on Steve Bruce. The eyewitness being the Birmingham Mail photographer who... the quotes are hilarious.
It's like The Onion, isn't it, like this? You wouldn't believe it's just made up.
So I said to the head of the police unit, I said, come on, we know how the cabbage entered the field of play. And she said, yeah, it was bowled on. And I said, exactly. The media have made a big hoo-ha of this. And I said, if you're going to be like banning or arresting this man, and I just rolled my eyes. And the Blues guy sitting opposite me, he was also, when you're looking at yourself and you're thinking, what has this world turned into, And you just say, please don't, let's not play silly boogers on this, because it's the press that's amped it up. And, the police admitted it, the press have obviously gone for the golden headlines, the golden cabbage headlines. And then there was a streaker who obviously ran on the pitch. And I said, well, the strict letter of law says that potentially they could be put on a sex offenders list for indecent exposure. And I said, the story is his pants actually fell down. He didn't actually willingly.
He didn't mean to. His cock fell out.
And, the police, they were laughing, and, they realised that, the trousers actually fell down on their own accord.
If anyone wants to relive the moment, just go to the Villa Underground's Twitter page and you can enjoy the moment said gentleman's pants fall down his ankles. VillaUnderground.com was there.
Nice plug. So, and I said, and they said, no, we obviously, we don't go out to throw everything at them. So there is some common sense there. But just to put a word out there, one of the main complaints across the board, whether it's Villa, Blues, West Brom, is just these external, I think the K2 stewards that come in, which are obviously third party stewards. And they seem to be at the root of most problems. And, if a steward hits you, if you report it to the police, the police will deal with them. It's not like they're both in the same side. And
the law still applies, doesn't it?
Yeah, the law still applies. And that's what the police keep reiterating to us. They said, we don't actually get criminal complaints from fans about stewards if they've got pushed or hit. And even when we see it on CCTV camera, we can't charge them unless somebody actually makes a criminal complaint, criminal charge. So the moral of this story is if you get hit by a steward or see somebody get hit by a steward, get them to make the claim against the stewards, because normally it won't be the stewards employed by the club. It will be these third party ones who have probably had like 2 seconds of training and just pushed out there without this agency really caring what environment they're in.
Like the morons at Aston train station who don't let anybody on the platform.
Well, that's your personal life. We don't care about
that.
But, sorry, I'm waffling on about this police meeting, but I forgot the best bit was they got the drone man in. Now, the drones are going to be used increasingly at, let's say, high-risk football games more and more. I think the Baggies had a test run when they played Reading. They tested this drone out. And they're going to use it for the Villa Blues game. And as you probably know, if you've been to a Villa Blues game, over the years, there's normally like helicopters flying around. And I remember the first one I went to ever was that when we won the League Cup in 94 when we played them in the second round over two legs. And that was a night game. And I just remember this helicopter coming down really close with a strobe light, not a strobe light, sorry, a spotlight.
Strobe lights, very, yeah.
Acid!
Strobe light on the turnstiles, and it was like being in a war zone. It was very dramatic. But obviously, these things cost money. Drone doesn't cost anything in comparison.
And I mean, what are the odds that one of these drones is going to be hit by a root vegetable at some point, and they'll have this coming together of all these issues?
So you've got like, imagine a long table full of delegates from the police and football supporters, and then you've got this guy comes in with this like a trolley full of big cases which have drones of various size, and one of them is the big motherfucker drone, which has got thermal imaging equipment. And so he shows us a small drone, you know, the daytime one, and then he starts breaking out this big one and like, you know, snapping it together. And then I'm just thinking about, he's not seriously going to turn this fucker on, is he? And I'm starting to think about RoboCop, the first one.
The enforcement droid, Series 209, is a self-sufficient law enforcement robot. 209 is currently programmed for urban pacification, but that is only the beginning. Mr. Kenny.
Yes, sir.
Would you come up and give us a hand, please?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kenny is going to help us simulate a typical arrest and disarming procedure. Mr. Kenny, use your gun in a threatening manner.
Yes, sir.
Please put down your weapon. You have 20 seconds to comply.
I think you'd better do what he says, Mr. Kenny.
You now have 15 seconds to comply. You are in direct violation of Penal Code 113, Section 9. You now have 5 seconds to comply.
That was the kind of vibes you were getting with this drone guy who was very excited about his drones. But what do you think about this idea of drones watching you at all times when you're going to the football?
I don't understand how the vast, vast majority of football fans who attend even high-risk football matches are law-abiding citizens. I don't understand it. I can't think of any other public thing you attend where you give up so much civil liberty and you're surveilled in such a way. I can't think of any other thing where it would be tolerated, to be honest.
They kind of brush that under the table, the whole civil liberties thing.
It's a big issue.
Exactly. And they say, like, during the game, there's never any problem. So what it does then is we can use it to survey the car park. So at least you know that your cars are safe while you're watching the game because the drone is watching them. Mm. And you're thinking, yeah, I'm sure they're on that 90 minutes. They're on, like, their lunch break or whatever. And, the drone's back in its case and they don't really care. But they're making it out to be a public service when, it's a grey line.
Well, I just think the good proper policing with good proper intelligence has managed football matches bar the prominent mistakes, should we say, for over 100 years. I don't understand why. I've always been very dubious about them. You know, when they set the camera up at the front of the terrace and start training it on the way groups of fans who, if anything, I find it, you know, it's not right, but I think it does incite people to behave in a certain way. And I don't think it's necessary.
They film the home fans as well, especially like in R1, they've blocked off R1, but R2 of the North Stand. And, you know, they used to do it in like L8 of the Holt as well.
What I don't get is the bit that they're trying to police around the ground is CCTV'd to within an inch of its life anyway. Mm. How could you possibly need any more video footage?
Yeah, I think it's just more like the area in general, so you can watch everything from train stations and...
Mm.
I think it's almost just kind of like toys for toys' sake, because to be fair, I think with certainly the last 2 years with the Villa Blues games, they've actually policed, especially at Villa Park, they've nailed it, I think, with sending all the Blues fans into Witten, closed off the road, and nothing's gone off before the games. It's probably more useful at St Andrews, where it's a much harder ground to police.
Yeah, no, the St Andrews thing is...
It's one road in and one road out.
It's always a big debate in these meetings in terms of solving the problem and, you know, holding in fans, etc. I mean, the police are asking, supporters, how do you feel about being held in, you know, is it inconvenienced? Is it? Would you rather go straight out, or you know, is there benefits from your point of view?
Well, I mean, I've experienced both over the years. I'm sure you guys and many others have that I think both cause their own issues. I mean, where I take issue with both sides is that I think by holding back, it always, you know, who's the obvious person wandering out into and around Small Heath an hour after the game? You know, you can have as many drones as you want. All you're going to see is the inevitable. And yeah. I always think as well, there are groups of people who, if they're going to have trouble, they're not going to do it in and around the immediate part of the ground either. That type of football violence has shifted in the last couple of generations.
Yeah, those guys are so much more clued up. They're not going anywhere near the stadium. Then I don't think anybody who wants to have it off is going to be stupid enough to do it where they know there's prying eyes of camera.
But I raised the point that it's fair enough saying to fans at the away fans at St Andrews, saying, look, we're going to hold you in for 30 minutes. Now, make sure you're actually doing something in that 30 minutes to, let's say, clear the way. Because last time, you know, they were left in there for like 2 hours because the police really didn't deal with the problem.
Yeah, because all you get is a big mob of a minority of Blues fans who just stand outside the gates with a line of police. And it's like, well, everyone's at a standoff now. It's just
there is a solution, though.
Batons.
No, better than that. The water cannon. Get the water cannon.
Let's go all Italian on them.
Oh, I tell you, the water cannon was deployed to expert use. Which Euros was it? That one that...
Was it Euro 2000?
You know, that was very underutilised paramilitary technique, in my view. But... No, less on drones, more on high-pressure water.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we're only talking about this in the context of St Andrews, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
Or a drone with tear gas.
So anyway, if you're going to the Villa Blues, watch out for that drone. See if you can spot it.
Arm your potato cannons now.
Anyway, let's get into Aston Villa and the whole new dawn, the new wave, the new... he came onto the pitch like he was greeted like some messiah. But as you rightly said at the top of the show, when we did a reaction piece... You know, we weren't there just to give you the hype of it and, you know, blind hype, because, you know, there were doubts. If you look at it just in the clear light of day, just on the facts, there is this, it's simple, just the results don't warrant the position when you haven't finished higher than ninth. I mean, we're talking about whatever the context here. When you haven't finished higher than ninth in 8 seasons in any league... And in terms of actual results, you know, isn't really a winner. You know, Brentford, I think 57 wins out of 142 games, and then only 84 out of 260 games at Warsaw. So those are the cold facts here. And also, Brentford finished fifth in the Championship before he took over, and obviously he's been ninth, tenth, and ninth since. So we'll talk about the context of that in a minute. So those are the cold light of day. But when he did his press conference, you're thinking, obviously, they brought him in as a coach. I mean, you've got to remember that it's not necessarily he's the manager and it's all on his shoulders, because this isn't the structure he's walking into here. So it's not like that he's the manager and that's it. you know, all our hopes rest on him. There's obviously a structure above him now as well. So this could be a perfect storm in terms of he's a coach, he's a talented coach, and he just needed that platform to show, you know, what he could truly do. And this feels like, you know, this is how it goes right.
Well, Christian Perslow, our new CEO, he went to great lengths really to emphasise that, didn't he? He wanted to make it very clear that aside from the coaching element and that pre-match preparation, that everything else was being taken away from Smith.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the supporting cast that's being assembled around him has responsibility for that. Always an interesting concept in English football, I think, because the first guy to get the fall guy is often still the head coach slash manager. So we will see, ultimately.
But Smith was impressive in terms of how he's come across so far.
I agree.
Because I was thinking, because I remember just about the days of Graham Turner when he came into Villa. At that time, you know, 2 years before that, we were, you know, champions of Europe.
Mm.
Graham's been sold to us by Ellis as this bright young manager from the lower league, Shrewsbury.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, okay, let's, you know, this is the, we're getting somebody on the up here and it's the next bright young thing. And here we go. And, you know, we're getting Didier Seasin, and you thought, oh, it might happen. Alas, not. I had the same feeling. I'm not saying it will end like Graham Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that was the initial feeling, where when Graham Taylor came in and he was the bright young manager, he actually was a winner. He had won with Watford, he'd burnt through all the leagues, he'd got them promoted. They almost won the first division title with Watford. I think they finished second to Liverpool, and that was the season they got promoted. And so he was a winner. He was a winner in the lower leagues. He'd won stuff with Lincoln as well. Dean Smith hasn't got higher than ninth in the lower leagues, and people go, "Oh yeah, oh my Warsaw mate said they were playing scintillating football. It was amazing." And but Warsaw, like, they're finishing 13th, 14th. I mean, this isn't the spectrum of what a good team is in the lower leagues. If you've got a manager who gets your shit together, you can do, you know, you can do major things, because the levels in terms of who's got the best players, etc., are, you know, it's closer in terms of spectrum than, you know, even the Championship, for example. So if he was super impressive as a manager, I would expect him to be, you know, getting a team into the playoffs at least in the lower leagues. But
I think, do you think in part that's a reflection of it was another point that Perslow made a couple of times during the press conference, and I did think it was one of Villa's better press conferences, not something you'll ever hear me say. Around that, Dean Smith brings a clear style of play, and that is something that we have been bereft of for a number of seasons. And I think that perhaps it's not the complete package. And I think, I mean, I spoke to some Brentford fans. You've obviously had some contact with some Warsaw fans, and that seems to be the message coming through from them, that you'll know the style.
Yeah,
we as a club have been crying out for someone with a vision. I think that what we don't know is whether that vision can come to fruition and promotion with us, and it has to.
Exactly. So, on the plus side, you know, Aston Villa, how are they going to sell this manager, new head coach to the fans? Well, they've only got one way of selling it, and that's the old hashtag one of our own. And I mean, it's been successful, because I think that's all, you know, certain population of Villa fans actually need, really. If you're a Villa fan, then everything's hunky-dory. But
Gabby factor.
But Dean Smith, in that press conference, he didn't hang on to that at all. He almost dismissed it.
He completely dismissed it, didn't he? He kind of said, "Do you know what? I'm here on merit," and he was very open about
and
that.
And said, "You know, I've had 30 years in the profession, etc., etc."
Yeah.
So, and that was kind of impressive. And going back to Dan's point, that's what you need from this guy as the head coach, is to get them playing. Leave it up to Jesus Garcia.
Leave it up to Jesus.
Should we call him Jesus, or should we call him JGP? He needs a name.
Weren't the club? Calling him Suso, which I'm not too sure about.
Suso, we need to give him a podcast name though. Should we call it
Richard?
Richard
Madeley?
I was going to say, should we call him Mancini?
Madeley
Mancini.
That works for me.
Okay, we'll call him Madeley Mancini. If we're talking Madeley Mancini, you know who we're talking about. So it's up to him to get the players in. Essentially, obviously, Smith will give him what he wants.
Can we just stop? On Richard Madeley, he's got a very checkered CV. Well, he just seems to. It just seems a bit patchy, and I think that Valencia have got well documented problems on and off the pitch. And This is always the challenge with a director of football role, is that the manager becomes goes into this head coach role and is then immediately reliant upon the players that get filtered through. I think even in Villa's case, you look this season at the type of players. We haven't seen much of El Ghazi, we haven't seen much of Bolasie yet. And are those the kinds of players? I always think back to the Tom Fox Moneyball idea that those five or six players that were filtered through have to hit the ground running immediately, or the manager or the head coach in this case gets the flak.
Yeah, because Brentford, going back to Dean Smith, Brentford were one of the prime examples of him of its that system actually working in the English game.
Yeah,
and obviously Dean Smith, has been working that system and to I wouldn't say great success, because we're talking ninth, tenth, and ninth from fifth. But decent success, and they've made a lot of money from it.
Yeah.
I mean, Chris, you've run some of the numbers on this.
Yeah, over the last four seasons, they've made a $50 million profit, and that's actually a rising profit with the likes of the deal for Ryan Woods, who's on loan at Stoke, but that he has a $7 million buying clause that will kick in January.
Maybe this is our cunning plan to get through FFP, that we'll just buy Brentford and we'll just transform ourselves.
But
break the 50 million.
That 50 million profit was on 11 players, and they bought those players for 6.7 million, 11 players, and then sold them for 57.3.
Yeah. That's remarkable.
No, they sold them for 60.8 million.
Wow.
That's crazy. And as I said, on a couple of the other deals they did, they are continuing to get money from them, for the likes of Andre Gray,
Scott Hogan.
There's still money going for that. Harley Dean, obviously Yotta, Maxime Collymore were at Blues. They made a fortune out of those deals from one Harry Redknapp.
But what people tend to forget, that Smith obviously had money to replace these players, and he did. I mean, you just mentioned Woods. He was bought in by Smith, to replace outgoing players. That balmy period where the Blues decided that Brentford was the way forward, and they bought out... was it three players or four?
It was three players on deadline day, wasn't it, as well? So it's about £6 million they spent.
So I think that in the context of when people say, oh, yeah, he's finished, you may say he's finished ninth, but what about the context? That's the main time, should I say, that I think, well, okay, nobody likes to lose three of their main players on deadline day.
I think they've built a sustainable thing where they're not like some of the so-called bigger clubs in the Championship, where they kind of, like someone like Villa, who has to be in the Premier League as soon as possible. Yeah. Brentford, it's a very sustainable model, but they can punch as much above their weight or not really. I saw a staggering...
Yeah, good coaching, obviously, that helps them do that, doesn't it? He has a system set up, and then as a player, they lose a player, they obviously just slot another one straight in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For example, I dread to think how much we spent when the Tony Shearer regime came in that first transfer window. But conversely to that, Brentford, in a 130-year history... have only spent $22 million on players.
Yeah.
And I think that, to pick up on your last
crazy
point, that I think that you have to have a plan. And Villa have I think deceived us into thinking that we've been on some sort of road, when actually it's been haphazard for a number of years, really, that we haven't been one playing to a plan, definitely not buying to a plan. And then you did use the analogy that the example you just gave, that if we lost a player or we're looking to develop the team, we don't buy a natural slot in, because we don't know what our formation, our system, our style of play is.
Yeah.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And, you know, just to bring us forward to talk briefly about the Swansea game, I thought immediately that you saw a manager who'd looked at the 11 and actually gone, well, let's try and pick the best or the most logical player for each position and we'll go with that initially.
Yeah, I mean, just to just explain that, you just looked at the back four straight away, put Taylor in, the two centre-backs that everybody with half a brain had been crying out for, and then came up with the idea of, well, let's, if you're playing a lone striker, push the two wide men a bit further forward and have them pressing up top as well, as Elmo was, and obviously Adomar on the other flank as well. And you just think, it's so simple, this. What was Bruce doing?
Yeah, as we've said a number of times, I think Bruce genuinely didn't know what his best 11 was and became embroiled in this idea of overcomplicating, trying to find a system that just was never going to work anyway. And I thought that was underlined by the centre midfield picking as well. It was fantastically balanced and so obvious that Bjarnason, who's got, both Bjarnason and McGinn have legs, they're quite harrying in their play, but Bjarnason's very composed. McGinn gives all the tenacity that you want in the centre there. And that's not to say that Hourihane or or others don't have a part to play in that. And it's the logical pick against Swansea that you want that type of players and complemented by, you know, some width with it. Because Bjarnason and McGinn were spraying into that space all day long, and it's good to watch. Very promising.
It's exactly what I thought when we played Fulham in that playoff final, where a good manager would have thought, right, Bjarnason sent him in the midfield instead of Jedinak. Jedinak gets the start. But then when we're chasing that game, we're 1-0 down, first half, we've barely gone over the halfway line. Then you think, well, we need somebody to pop up.
Yep.
And if he does nothing all game, one thing you know about Bjarnason, he will get a chance, because he reads the game and he can get in positions. And I would have thrown him on at half time straight away. And to see that Smith had already, you know, realised the kind of opponent they're playing, which is, you know, cut from the same cloth as the Fulham we just mentioned. I don't think it's the Swansea of yesteryear or recent years, but
no.
But still, they've still tried to play.
They were one of the better footballing sides I've seen in the division this season.
They were very tidy
because they carry they have a system which they've carried through the last let's say the last decade. And they've stuck to it. So there was definitely a lot better balance. And
balance is definitely the word.
And as I think on the way to the ground, you sort of see your phone pop up at 2 o'clock and see the team sheet announced. And for the first time this year, you kind of went, oh, wow, I'm not scratching my chin or wondering what the hell is this. You kind of thought, oh, yeah, that should be all right. And you look at the bench and go, yeah. And even through the game, you know, you looked at the substitutions he made and you weren't completely baffled by them.
Well, they were positive changes as well. And I think that if the manager had been Bruce, we'd have definitely seen the introduction of Whelans and a withdrawal of an out-and-out attacking player. And I think what it kept, whilst the game we were at risk at certain points, and you know, no way is Smith going to solve the problems of many years overnight, but I was very encouraged that even as the game went on, we were, whenever we got the ball, we were looking to create something, and my God, we missed some chances in that game and could have been out of sight, but equally, you know, that our frailties were still there for sure.
I mean, it did feel I don't want to labour too much on the game, but it did feel like the Reading game, because you can say, Bruce, everything's bad under Bruce. I mean, a lot of it was. But against Reading, we were actually, when we got the new guys in, El Ghazi and obviously Balassi, you know, didn't start that game. But we looked comfortable, but without that, you know, real penetration. And then we got caught, obviously, with our pants down at the end. But this time, I mean, it kind of felt the same, but there's a bit more, you saw the kind of method to the madness. It was a bit clearer what we were trying to do. Like I said earlier on, pushing those front, the wingers, the wider players higher up to obviously press the other team. But also you're giving, as well as giving Abraham some support, you're also giving Grealish, you know, willing runners options. When he gets the ball and starts running at the back line, he's got, you know, genuine wider options because they're actually running. I still don't think the midfield have kind of got onto the frequency yet, but obviously, you know, that will come as their instinct, you know, is kind of drilled into them that they need to be running and supporting and moving.
Yeah, I think already what you've noticed, certainly the two things that I noticed that he's, in the short time he's had with the players, the first thing was when we didn't have the ball, we looked a hell of a lot more compact. You know, we kind of, the midfield, sort of three with the wide men suddenly became a five, and we were very rigid and quite hard and very close to the back four. The other thing was you could tell straight away, he said, you know, as we've commented on numerous times, when our fullbacks get the ball, it was so predictable under Bruce what was going to happen. It was going to get launched down the line, and all of a sudden it was very much, let's keep the ball on the ground and let's work it until we can get into a good position. And like sometimes, you know, McGinn was guilty of it a few times, giving the ball away in silly areas, and Bjarnason did, and that's going to happen when you try and play like that. But at least you could see that, okay, this is what we're going to do, and we believe, and hopefully they believe in that.
And it wasn't pointless passing. Remember that phase where Paul Lambert decided he was going to turn it into a possession-based team? And we would
Westwood.
And we
ball.
Would just play it sideways, 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 backwards to the keeper, back out again, sideways, 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 back to the keeper.
Please, David. I'm having terrible flashbacks. But remember, would you please move on.
But I didn't get that. I didn't feel that during the game against Swansea.
It wasn't always comfortable, was it? But as Chris just said, it was.
I think that will come.
There was a little bit more purpose, and of course, you know, they gave the ball away at times, and you know, you've highlighted the players that did that.
Yeah. The flip side to that, I would say, is that McGinn was probably actually one of the worst for it on the ball. But the thing that gave him probably one of the man of the match performances, and Bjarnason was the same, was for every time they gave the ball back, those two didn't half work bloody hard to get it back. Mm. And more often than not, they did. Like McGinn was just
phenomenal,
vicious in the
tackle.
The funny thing
with McGinn is he'll lose the ball, and by the time you're just about to let out your expletive, like, bloody hell, he's got the ball back. He's got the ball back by the time you said bloody hell.
Oh, it's all right. He's already stamped.
Oh, he's got it back. He's all right.
He's already holding the spine of that person.
And two people who relatively went under the radar on Saturday, who would deserve a little bit of credit for actually being played in their position and actually putting a good shift in. One was Neil Taylor, who I thought grew into the game. The other, I think we probably saw Twan Zabi's best performance in a Villa shirt. I think he started to look much more assured. He's obviously a really good athlete, and he's starting to just look a lot more confident playing with Chester. And I think that combination is only going to grow. And I hope that the goalkeeper takes confidence from the from a clean sheet.
Let's not blow smoke up his arse just yet.
Let's not.
I had to smile a little bit because Smith in his post-match basically said, well, some saves I'd expect him to make. And that, it's got
Absolutely.
To be a little bit like that for Nyland for a few weeks because his performance mirrored Villa's, really. There were some good points, but actually there were some quite scary moments where you can see the team's a bit nervy around him as well.
It's like just because a goalkeeper's made three saves, you don't give him the man of the match and blow smoke up his arse. Because you've got to remember, keepers are meant to make saves, but also the men are make you feel a bit comfortable if they're doing their job.
Yeah.
I never felt comfortable ever with him so far.
I think everybody who's watched Villa this year and in the ground on Saturday was just hoping and praying at some point soon you see a cross come in and he just comes and clears everyone out and catches it. And everyone can just go, oh, okay, we're all right here, because I'm still yet to see him actually come from
across. There will be a massive cheer when that happens, I think. Maybe the first time it might be an ironic cheer, but I think it will be a supportive ironic cheer.
I don't think any Villa fan doesn't
want
a player to come good. And I think
if we're going to get promoted, we need him to come good, put it that way.
So, well, the awful thing is it's a long time till January, so I'd rather the guy found some form and ironed out the errors, should we say, in that time.
What do you think about the crowd at the game? Because I was up with the, let's say, the noisier, the heart and soul of the Holt, and still, I think, you know, at 20 minutes, I was seeing people walk off to get pies and stuff, and I'm just finding it bizarre. I'm having a bit of a culture shock compared to, you know, back in the day when nobody bloody left the terrace until, you know, either half time or obviously at the end of the game. But people seem to be in and out as if there's some real exciting stuff happening on the concourse that I'm not aware of. But after the initial, obviously, the Doug Ellis applause, and then, you know, the reception for Smith, and, you know, the opening, let's say, 10, 15 minutes was pretty good, it kind of did drop off a bit. And especially the second half, it got a bit nervy. And there was, you know, a couple of moments where the crowd realised, you know, the role they can play in, like, lifting the players to get them back on track. But if it's a full house, people need to get engaged. It's not like a day out.
I think there's a certain amount of there's that kind of smoke without fire. It's the fans are almost waiting to be in. The fans are waiting for that catalyst, whereas actually the fans probably need to be the ones to kind of pull the crowd. You know, it's a two-way
thing.
I'm
just talking about in terms of everybody being focused for promotion, because this is the business we're in now.
And it's a, and it's a, and it's a very achievable goal.
And the
goal.
Good thing is we've got a manager now, as we saw, that everybody's getting behind, and this kind of galvanizes us, but we've all got to kind of play our parts in some respect. Have something to eat before you get to the game, so you don't need to go for that pie in 20 minutes.
Get pissed up and have a right good sing-song.
Exactly. Something like that. Let's go. We haven't touched on the assistant coaches, or the assistant head coaches, should I call them. Obviously, Dean Smith operated with two back in Brentford. Thomas Frank, who came from Bromby, has now gone on to be the top man at Brentford. So we have Richard O'Kelly. I keep thinking Richard Kelly, who directed Donnie Darko. Richard O'Kelly, and he's in his 60s, and he's obviously been like a bit of a senior figure for Dean Smith at Warsaw and Brentford. And then obviously Mr. John Terry's came along. I did quite like Richard O'Kelly. His interview was quite fun. He was like amazed to be here.
Yeah. everything.
Amazing. Such friendly people.
I think it was a stroke of genius who ever decided to split out Smith and Purslow and then put O'Kelly and Terry in separate conferences. I think that was actually very clever. And again, it was one of you're expecting Car Crash TV, aren't you, whenever you tune into to Villa's stuff? But it was an insight into the guy, and as you say, you couldn't help but warm to him. And, you know, again, he's earned his right to have his crack at it. And he was first to admit it, wasn't he, that this is a big club and it's a big opportunity. And he was in awe, wasn't he?
This is the first person, let's say, in my time of doing My Old Man Said, who has done an interview and has actually genuinely meant it's a big club with excitement because of what he's used to.
That's so true.
Everybody else is scripted. It's what you say, right?
That is
right,
true.
I'm going to ask you, what's it like to be at Villa? Just say big club, you know, blah, blah. But this guy was not off, you know, he wasn't on script. He was just talking genuinely. And he was like, bloody hell, it's a big club, this one.
And then also, he clearly had been taken aback by some of the technical ability of the players as well, that they were, you know, that there was genuinely a step up there. And that's actually promising on the one hand.
He was like, we got these fuckers playing liquid football at Brentford, but they couldn't even finish above ninth.
They're fucking clog dancers at Brentford. Look what we've
got this bloody pub team. We'll be winning Champions League with this lot, though.
I think what was nice to see with all of them in both the interviews was that they all clearly see it as a huge opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
You look at what could have been the case with Henri, and it was very obviously a stepping stone for him. Mm. For these guys, they kind of, I think they really feel they can do some good here.
And I mean, I'm delighted that Terry's back as well. You know, out the closet in terms of Terry, but I think that it's a real good, I agree what you're saying, it's an opportunity for him to quietly perhaps go about his business, but also I think he's the right type of personality to be having in and around the dressing room. He gets that buy-in from the players, which is something we pondered before. But actually,
he's the right person at the right time, isn't he?
Well, and as David said before, he's got genuine unfinished business, and he's a winner, and I can't see him not wanting to turn up every day and win. And I think that's a good, you know, it's not someone sitting there saying, oh, I want to win, I want to do well for Aston Villa. This guy's been there and done it, and with a lot of media scrutiny as well in his private and, you know, his professional life. Good influence to have around Villa Park.
Because, you know, when he slipped on his arse when he took that penalty against Manchester United in Moscow, what did Chelsea do? They ended up winning it in the end. Like, you know, he had unfinished business in that, and he managed to, you know, rectify that. So when he looks back on his career, when he's a granddad, he'll be thinking, "Well, I never got Villa up, and well, hopefully not." but if he sorts it out now as a coach, then as you know, as far as he's concerned, he sorted out the job.
Absolutely.
Also, I think it's a great opportunity for Terry because he, as you say, he gets to become that coach and learn the trade. I mean, he's obviously had a lot of experience through some of the managers he's worked under, but he actually gets it to put it in practice in less of a spotlight than, say, Gerrard and Lampard, who have gone balls in.
Which was a point that he made in the press conference, wasn't it? And I don't think it was meant as a dig, but he was self-deprecating in saying that he wasn't ready to make that step up.
Well, he was talking about the top job in 4 or 5 years.
Which
was interesting, and to have that chance to develop as a coach at a big club, I'll say it as Richard O'Kelly is kind of unique because a lot, you know, you were talking, Dan, about when I asked you about John Terry, will you make, well, I think we had a listener question, would John Terry make a good manager? And you were talking about, well, you know, he needs lower league experience. And I think he will get this, obviously, at Villa, but he will yes. that same kind of experience, yeah. but with a big club where hopefully he'll end up managing if he becomes a manager later on in his career. So it's like real experience.
Well, it also puts us on, it gives us that, hopefully, this is the kind of model we're striving for, isn't it, where football clubs, top football clubs with good organisation, they don't have to go outside their football club to recruit. It's quite a European thing, isn't it, where you get a, you know, your head coach may leave, but you might get someone promoted from the academy or from the coaching setup, because then you have that continuity of style, which is a thing that Swansea did really.
I mean, the prime example was Pep. You know, Pep was the B team coach at Barcelona and went straight up into the first team.
So that, you know, your club mantra, your ethos, you know, that familiarity with good players who are coming through the academy and that style of play that you want to adopt as a football club, you can, in theory, adopt it as a whole club approach. But we're a long way from that.
And this is something that Aston Villa under, you know, Tony Shay and Wyness and Steve Round were preaching, you know, for the last two seasons, and it just never happened. But I think just the way it's been set up instantly here, and I think they've got the right coach. I mean, I was saying, obviously, his record doesn't suggest he would be a Villa manager, but but he's not a manager. He's the head coach, and he has an infrastructure to support him. And hopefully, I think I said a couple of podcasts ago, but he has a canvas now to actually, you know, paint on as a coach to see what he can actually do.
That's a good way of putting it. I agree with that. Yeah,
I think with Terry and with Dean Smith, we spoke about this before, was that Dean Smith had the measure of Villa over, I think, is it five games he's played against us now? And the Brentford performed, you know, most Villa fans were impressed with Brentford as a side. So he knows Villa's strengths and weaknesses. And as a fan, he knows the players. John Terry arrives knowing basically everybody there, other than probably someone like Al Ghazi. You know, he'll be on good terms with Tammy Abraham, which I think could be a really important relationship to get the best out of him. Mm. And he'll know Bolasie. He'll know all the players from last year. And he'll know where Villa were strong and weak last year. So I think it's not like you've got, say, like someone like an Henri, for example, who could have gone in there very cold and not known the lie of the land. The guys going in there actually know reasonably where Villa are at right now.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I imagine Thierry Henry is a very quick study, but it's different from actually having the experience.
But you've got hands-on experience, well, competing with Villa and competing against Villa.
But yeah, going back to what I was saying about Dean Smith, if he wasn't a Villa fan, based on his record, he's not an easy sell. I think the John Terry sideshow was a nice way of supporting it as a kind of package as well.
Yeah, and both personalities buy you time, don't they, ultimately? They buy a little bit of patience, and they'll kind of galvanise the supporters a little bit.
And Terry, you know, Terry seems humble in the context of learning to be a coach. And Dean Smith's obviously got a reputation of playing good football. So in the short term, I think it's all good. I mean, long term, if Dean Smith struggles or, you know, whatever, and John Terry actually turns out to be astute and he wants to manoeuvre for another position, then that's, you know, that's the long term. But in terms of the short term, I think it's a pretty solid option in terms of the options we potentially could have. Because let's face it, Dean Smith wants to prove himself at Villa, so it's an attractive job. Most of these other guys had things to lose. Or if they wanted to start, it looked like a bit of a dangerous, sticky wicket. So in terms of what we could have got with the available, let's say, managers on offer who are willing to take the job, I think it's pretty much as good as we could have got.
Absolutely. And Dean Smith, you look at him, he will be a long-term option. You know, unless he was to get an insanely good offer, I don't see him leaving Villa in any time soon unless he's fired. Because this is it for him. This is the opportunity.
Yeah, in terms of success, I would see him wanting to get us into Europe. If he was successful to get us out of this league, then success would be to get us challenging back where we were. Because that's his bread and butter when he was a kid.
Yeah. I mean, the comparison to someone, as has been documented, to put him in the same kind of ballpark as like an Eddie Howe or someone like that would be a good sort of, not blueprint necessarily to follow, but a really good sort of level to strive for over the next couple of, you know, two, three seasons.
But he's got that, because he was a kid and Villa were in Europe at that time, that's like a through line of ambition of, you know, where Villa should be, kind of thing.
Oh, well, he knows where he wants to set the
bar. You know, I don't want to overplay this, he's one of our own kind of malarkey, because ultimately that, you know, that won't matter for shit if he's not good enough.
Agreed.
Oh, Dan Rogers, are you still there?
I am. I thought you're making such succinct, valid points. I thought, why ruin it with my insanity?
Before we go on to our new segment, which we're not going to tell you what it's called just yet. Or did we say that at the top of the show? I can't remember.
We did.
Yeah, we did.
Before we go on to our new closing section, just a quick shout out to the new patrons that have signed up. A big thanks to Patrick Singleton, Lou Roberts, Sharon Patel, and Matt Rees. Thank you very much for helping support the podcast. And also...
Beautiful people. Beautiful.
And also supporting quality independent Villa coverage that likes to represent the readers and not patronize or lead them down in the clickbait model. If you also want to support us and become a My Old Man Said patron, please go to myoldmansaid.com and click on the patron option on the menu bar. Also, make sure you spread the word of the podcast. Write a nice review if you want. Give us 5 stars. And subscribe to whatever portal you use, whether it be iTunes, Spotify, Podcast Addict, etc., etc. Anyway, the new segment, Where Were You When We Were Good?
Where were you? Where were you?
Where were you?
Where were you?
Where were you?
Where were you?
When we were good. We'll work out a proper jingle.
Where were you? Where were you? That was going to be Antiques Roadshow. We're working on the jingle,
people. We'll get a proper jingle when we have more patrons so we can bribe somebody to do it for us. The idea of this is we will look back in history, but instead of just taking obvious moments like, oh, remember when we won the European Cup, we will take idiosyncratic moments that either led to something in Villa history. So, for example, the first one, just to get yourselves in the groove here, and it's because it's connected to the last podcast, which was our reissue of the Big Ron interview, and he actually talks about this moment.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about the semi-final of Tranmere Rovers, but we're not going to talk about the jaw-dropping hell-and-back experience of the second leg at Villa Park. Where were you when we were good is this moment.
We are now, in fact, into stoppage time. One of the most famous nights in Tranmere Rovers history has almost come to an end, and a glorious end at that. Villa must just get it forward. No pretty stuff now. We've just got to get it into the box. Townsend. And he's been fouled by Irons. Now they've got an opportunity to get it into the box and force something from the free kick.
Harsh decision. But we can talk and analyse the whys and the wherefores all night. But 3-0, what a decisive result in the first leg of a semi-final competition.
Richardson's kick and headed cross the face of goal, and Atkinson strikes it in. After all that time of concentration and defending, Tranmere finally concede one a minute into stoppage time. Daly's little flick header, and Atkinson rifled it in with his right foot for his 13th goal of the season and his fourth in this competition, to change the scoreline from 3-0 to 3-1. And how significant will that prove to be?
It was a terrific strike, wasn't it? I thought it was a harsh free kick.
It's all over, and it's ended in drama and almost, strangely enough, psychologically, a little bit of disappointment for Tranmere. The difference between 3-0 and 3-1 in a two-legged competition where away goals can count double could be a big difference indeed.
Right, so that was Dalian Atkinson's injury time goal, and he popped up again, didn't he, in the second leg, in the dying embers of that game. But Villa, I always remember, like, I mean, how much of the hard work could you have already done to get into the final? You've beaten Birmingham over two legs, you've beaten Sunderland away, beaten Spurs away, you're beating Arsenal away. I mean, whoever was doing the fucking draw was not helping Villa get to that final in any shape or form. And then they decided in the semi-final draw, they got a bit guilty and they thought, well, yeah, we've given them away trips to Arsenal and Spurs and Sunderland. But let's give them Tranmere in the semi, you know, safe passage into the final.
And have the away leg first.
Yeah,
there you go.
Everything, all the stars aligned. You know, we're already, you know, celebrating that we're going to the final and we're probably going to play Manchester United.
Some would call this classic Villa. By the way,
it is classic.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens? Tranmere, also, if that's not enough, if you need any more help, Tranmere Rovers' main two defenders are suspended for the game.
Perfect.
Villa, pretty much full strength team. Tranmere, I think they played three at the back. They played 3-4-3. Anyway, Tranmere Rovers, they were pretty good in that period of time, if I remember rightly. They were
John Aldridge.
Yeah, I think I can't remember if that's they. I think they beat Liverpool and Everton in cups. I don't know if it was that period or another Renaissance period they had. Anyway. Just dispatched us 3-0. Well, that's what they thought until the last minute when obviously the ball came in. Daly got up and headed it back and smart finish from Atkinson.
It was a good finish.
And it did sway the tie. But I always remember, I remember I was living in Handsworth back in those days and I had a ticket for the Villa Park semi-final and I was still pissed off. I was so pissed off about that first leg because everybody thought obviously the players thought the same thing. We're in the final already. We don't even have to turn up against this Tranmere Rovers outfit. And I remember being so pissed off that I didn't want to go. I thought, fuck, this is, as you said, so typical Villa. It's just, this is, you know, it's just disgusting. It's like...
So you packed all your cabbages.
So I got a big bag, put all my cabbages in. I thought, well, it's Sunday.
Going to bowl them on.
It's Sunday. Hang on a minute. I could cook that cabbage for my Sunday lunch, but I'm going to take this with me instead. And normally I'd get the bus to Villa Park, but this time I thought, right, I'm going to leave like earlier and just walk there. Just... To
solemnly
talk myself into going to the game, just kind of psych myself up. But what a game that was. But and obviously we had the same experience against Bradford.
Oh my God. Paul Lambert, Bradford, twice in the same podcast. Why would you do this?
But I think the difference was that because that goal was in the in injury time, it did swing that momentum a little bit. Bradford, there was just, you know, just disgust. How can you get beat 3-1 by Bradford? Bradford were even lower.
He should have been sacked there.
I mean, Tranmere Rovers were in the Championship, but Bradford were even, you know, fucking. Were they Sunday League team? I can't remember.
I haven't heard of them since. Put it that way.
But no, so that was a kind of a pivotal goal that, because I don't think if we go to Villa Park 3-0 down against Rovers, I don't think we get out of that alive.
Nah.
And if it obviously played out as it was, and Tranmere were unlucky not to get through that. I mean, even the last kick of the game in injury time hit the post.
Yeah, I mean, my memory of that Atkinson goal particularly is, I mean, I was quite young at the time, but abject disbelief that we were losing 3-0, but how. At the point at which the free kick's taken, you know, the ground is absolutely bouncing around them.
Yeah.
And how still the ground, you know, all football fans know the importance of, you know, that chink of light that you're back in the fixture, aren't you, with that goal. And quite a low-key celebration from the Villa players, because I tell you what, it's a fine volley from Atkinson as well, absolutely hammered into the
Because Atkinson, the players didn't like charge, cause I think it was so late in injury time, they didn't charge and get the ball and, you know, run out, take it out of the net and run back to the centre circle. Atkinson basically just turned around and just kind of jogged back.
Yeah.
But I think they, as Ron Atkinson said in that interview, he was, they felt like the winners of that game and Tranmere Rovers, you know, came in with their, shoulders slumped because they knew at 3-0 they were pretty much through. Chris wasn't born because he hasn't said a word yet.
No, I was born.
I was born.
As
soon as that ball hit the net, that was when you were conceived through the celebration.
To a chorus of hallelujahs.
Where were your parents when we were good?
But do you remember that game, or do you just remember the second leg, Chris?
I remember the second leg more. I remember watching the second leg.
I can't remember how long it took me to actually watch the highlight, because I didn't see the game. Obviously, I wasn't at Tranmere for the first leg, and I think I just heard it on the radio. I was following it on the radio.
Same here.
Back in the day, kids, you couldn't stream stuff in the 90s. You had to rely on your transistor radio if you wasn't at the game.
You had to listen to Tom Ross.
Remember when Villa, the first time we played Inter Milan under Graham Taylor, we'd won
Kent Nielsen.
This talking to transistor radios. We won the first leg 2-0. We should have won by so much more. A great performance. And then we went to the San Siro, and I think.
Oh, you're talking dirty now. Keep talking San Siro. Go on.
Cascarino had a chance. Maybe McGrath had a chance. But I was working. I think I was at school doing A-levels or GCSEs or whatever. So I had like a, you know, part-time job at Tesco's or whatever. And I couldn't watch the game because I was working. So I bought a transistor radio just for this fucking game. And I finished at 8 o'clock. So I was working like with a kickoff. So like listening to like 15 minutes. And I'm running over this bridge to the train station to get my train back home. So I'm listening to the game and it's 2-0. The goals start flooding in as soon as I'm going over this bridge. And I get onto the train starts, put the radio back on. And basically the commentary of the third goal is on and the window's open. So I just throw the transistor radio out the train window and make my way home. But yeah, no, those were the days, kids. Transistor. I kind of miss that in a certain way. I remember listening to Villa on like European games, like UEFA Cup, Spartak Moscow, whatever. And you had to listen. It's like da 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 da. Midweek sports special.
It's like going and buying the pink paper, wasn't it? And half the results wouldn't have even been printed in it. Oh, yeah.
How'd you get away with selling that?
Good old Sports Argus.
Where were you when we were good? It's a fantastic segment. If you've got any ideas in terms of little, if you want us to waffle about any particular moment that may have been lost in the annals of history of Aston Villa, either tweet us at AVFC podcast or send us an email at contact@myoldmansaid.com.
And congratulations if you can actually remember when we were good.
God, he always toxic, but always finishes on a low note.
Well, that's the upper halt in my opinion.
Let's have a prediction now. Dean Smith, Aston Villa, New Dawn. Where do you think we'll finish at the end of this season?
Football's coming home. God.
I don't like predictions.
The Premier League's coming home.
Do you know what? I think he's got something massive in his favour. There's no runaway team. This, I think if we get ourselves organised.
Leeds are already starting to fold.
Well, they're doing their usual implosion, aren't they? And this horrible set of December fixtures, the only real positive I can see is that we're going to be playing teams that are around us and that are supposedly competing with us. Get through that. We've got a great opportunity.
Yeah, you look at that month and I just see that as an opportunity. You know, because I just don't think there's anybody to be feared in that division, especially teams coming to Villa Park. If you get our shit together.
Yeah, there's only one team that looked like they're there 100% for the long haul, and that's Middlesbrough, just because you look at, they've only conceded 7 goals so far this season. They're not scoring that many, but...
No, that's the other thing.
What I'm saying is they look like they're going to be a consistent grinder.
Yeah, they can grind it out. You look at all the other teams and you think if they don't play well, they aren't going to win.
Well, on the mental image of Tony Pulis grinding, is that where we draw things to a close?
It is indeed.
Oh, that's what a way to end.
Just think about that with his little baseball cap, his Borough baseball cap on. Right, on that note, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, goodbye, good Villa folk.
My old man said...
Somebody's creaking on their chair.
Yeah, that was me then, sorry.
I'm going to cut your legs off so you won't need a chair.
cut the legs off the chair. And
I'm just going to mount you in a holder. Just your head so you can use your mouth.
Just in a vice.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.